AgriTalk is brought to you by Full Scale from Helena. Grow strong returns this season with breakthrough foliar nutrition from Full Scale at Reproduction. And by propane. Propane is the energy for everyone, especially farmers. Environmentally friendly propane can fuel most anything on the farm. See how at propane.com. Just a few days of March remain, and many market watchers are wondering what's up with the Kansas winter wheat crop. We will get some answers to those questions. And yesterday, we started a conversation about the Iowa House efforts to protect landowner rights as carbon capture, utilization, and storage projects move forward. We'll keep it going today.
Live from Newsman's Monday via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning, we begin with a conversation with Jeannie Falk-Jones, an agronomist from K-State. Then it's Elizabeth Burns-Thompson from Navigator CO2. And right after the news, Karen Bonert from Farm Journal's Milk. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson, and now the host of AgriTalk, Chip Flory.
Gee, she kind of made me half think it was Monday there for a second. I had to go back in time and make sure that, no, today is Tuesday. It's all good.
Yeah. It's
all good.
It's Newsman's Monday is what it is.
I get it. I get it now. Welcome back. It's good to have you back.
Great to be here.
Well, good.
Super psyched.
Excellent.
I got to visit the North Country, you know, the land of my homeland. Uh-huh. And on Sunday, I was doing stuff. I had work to do.
Right.
And I was so distracted. The snow was so lovely.
Yeah, just
fluttering down. And it's like every snowflake was singing a little song to me. And it was entrancing, really. It's gorgeous up there in the north.
Yeah, well, it's pretty much gone now. And I don't know. It was some sort. The music that I heard with that snow as it was coming down was some sort of scratchy, metallic.
The locals were less than impressed, as I understand it.
Right, right. Absolutely. Absolutely. We've got a lot of ground to cover on today's show. Before we get there, though, our thoughts are with everybody in the Nashville area dealing with another tragedy down there. It's hard to put into words. It's impossible to put into words how you feel when things like that school shooting happen. We need to do something, and it starts with the people. And we need to make sure that we're taking care of people, and we are vigilant of people and intentions. It's not easy. It's not easy, but it is an effort that we as a people need to take on, Davis.
Yes, well said. I agree.
Okay. All right. I'm looking forward to the conversations today. It's the end of March. This hard red winter wheat crop should be breaking dormancy. We'll find out what's going on, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the carbon pipelines and how the development of those projects are going. All right, let's get to the news. What do you got?
Well, Chip, I don't know what happened yesterday, but today USDA reported another daily export sale of corn to China, this time 136,000 metric tons for the 22-23 marketing year. Dude, the daily sales just keep rolling.
Yeah, there was a daily sale announced yesterday. But
seriously?
It wasn't to China.
Oh.
It was to unknown destinations.
so the Netherlands then, clearly.
Destinations Spain? In yesterday's case could be spelled C-H-I-N-A. I think that's probably right.
Yeah. Well, Chip, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association is calling on Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack to continue blocking Paraguay from importing beef to the United States. This comes as USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service is proposing to amend its regulations to allow the importation of fresh, chilled, or frozen beef from Paraguay. What's the kerfuffle here?
Paraguay's got an issue with foot and mouth disease, and that stuff is transmittable in food and product. We should not be bringing in beef from Paraguay.
Fair enough. Well, President Joe Biden vowed to veto the House GOP energy package if it lands on his desk in its current form. as it contains measures that the White House said, quote, would pad oil and gas company profits and undercut our public health and environment. The package includes provisions to boost oil and gas drilling on federal lands, repeal parts of the Inflation Reduction Act, and expedite permitting for energy projects.
Yeah. Boy, if this one makes it all the way to the president's desk, it's got a big old veto on it.
Well, gas and diesel prices fell again last week. The nation's average gasoline price declined 3 cents to an average of $3.40 per gallon. That's 7.8 cents higher than a month ago, but 83 cents lower than a year ago. The national average diesel price dropped 5.9 cents to $4.19 per gallon. That's 92.7 cents lower than a year ago. However, Gas Buddies Patrick DeHaan warns prices may begin moving higher again. The U.S. and Japan have agreed to a trade deal on electric vehicle battery minerals as part of an attempt to counter China's dominance in that industry. And this is interesting, Chip. According to U.S. intelligence sources, the number of mines now laid in agrarian areas of Ukraine mean the country will increasingly become dependent on imports and humanitarian aid ahead, and Ukraine will no longer be the breadbasket of Europe. Yeah. Meanwhile, Romania and Poland are in talks with the European Commission over export tracing mechanisms for Ukrainian grains to ensure their local farmers are not hurt by a flood of cheap imports. Kind of a push-pull thing here on the Ukrainian supplies.
Yeah, a third of the Ukrainian farmland reportedly is infected with mines now. So tell me, how really concerned is Putin about all the hungry people out there in the world?
All right.
Yeah, not.
Well, and finally here, a large coalition of ag and business groups have asked President Joe Biden to intervene in West Coast port labor negotiations. The coalition previously voiced concerns when the labor contract expired in July last year.
All right. Thank you very much, Davis. Let's bring in Karen Bonert, editor of Farm Journal's Milk. Good morning, Karen.
Hi, Chip.
Okay, DFA, Dairy Farmers of America, celebrated 25 years at its annual meeting. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, the meeting in Kansas City was well attended as always. They shared that $700 million, Chip, was deferred in milk checks last year, which is a strong indicator that, one, 2022 was a fantastic milk price year, and number two is that producers made sound strategic financial management plans as they knew the tides were going to quickly change coming into 2023. Also interesting was that from their member surveys, DFA foresees fewer than 5,500 member owners by the year 2030. This is, you know, a significant drop. And this just shows that the consolidation and herd sellouts are going to come at a quicker pace in the next 3 to 7 years. This will include farms that don't have that younger generation coming back, haven't made capital investments on their farms, plan to retire, or really just plan to do something else with their farmstead. Chip, I was also, during that trip, zigzagging my way back to Illinois with my daughter, who was looking at colleges in the Midwest. And at Iowa State University, a professor last week told me that 80% of students now in animal science are female. Let me tell you, 25 years ago, this was a male-dominated field. So the reason I bring up is there are obviously fewer farm kids are coming back to the farm, but are going to college to study ag-related fields. And piggybacking off of DFA remarks of fewer farms, we also need to ask who are going to be the farmers, who's going to work on the farm, and who's going to support the farmers from pharmaceutical to veterinarians to nutritionists. I believe the change that's coming to agriculture, it's specifically dairy, will be huge.
Yeah. Yeah. It is noticeable down at Iowa State as well. I speak at one of the class on occasion and in the animal science department, and it is amazing. It is amazing how dominated it is by the female students there. So,
yep.
All right, Karen, hey, thank you so much. Appreciate it. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Chip.
Jeannie Falk-Jones is going to give us an update on the Kansas wheat crop next.
To produce higher yields and greater value at harvest, timing is everything. Full Scale from Helena helps soybeans reach their full potential with breakthrough foliar nutrition and reproduction. Full Scale delivers beneficial plant extracts and micronutrients with the added efficiency of ENC formulation technology. It gives your soybeans every opportunity to grow strong returns this season. Contact your local ag retailer or Helena representative to learn more about Full Scale. Always read and follow label instructions and check registration status before use.
From powering irrigation engines to warming buildings, propane has always been a part of American farm life. Now, you can be a part of propane's future and save money at the same time. The Propane Farm Incentive Program is a research initiative that provides farmers up to $5,000 towards the purchase of new propane-powered equipment. In exchange, participants share performance data to make tomorrow's ag operations more cost-effective, more efficient, and more environmentally friendly with propane. Getting started is simple. Visit propane.com/farm incentive to see if you're eligible.
On your favorite radio station or your preferred digital device, AgriTalk is live every weekday.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm Chip. Glad that you are with us this morning. Davis Michelson is back behind the big green leafy microphone. Everything's
looking good. I
sure am. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Excellent. Davis, it's the end of March. It is March 28th already.
It's like the end of March now.
Yeah.
It's the 28th already.
It is. It does not even feel possible, but the wheat markets around the world are going to be looking for some messages from the hard red winter wheat crop as it is supposed to be greening up. And that Kansas wheat crop in particular is going to be in focus. Jeannie Falk-Jones is a Kansas State multi-county extension agronomist, and she joins us right now. Jeannie, welcome to AgriTalk.
Thanks for having me.
Glad that you're here. Now, you're out in northwest Iowa, correct? Or northwest Kansas, jeez.
Kansas, correct? Yes. Yes, yeah. I am in the very far northwest corner of the state. But I've been traveling a lot here lately, and so I've seen a little bit of across the state of how wheat is good. Looking. But yes, my main office is on the experiment station in Colby.
Okay, out Colby. Good, good. Did you catch some of that snow this past weekend?
We did, actually. We still have some snow on the ground. We're thankful for any bit of moisture that we can attract from Mother Nature.
Yeah. How much good do you think it did or is doing?
You know, snow is always a little bit of a challenge. This last snow had some pretty good moisture in it. We're happy to have any bit of moisture we can attract. The thing is, we're starting at a pretty good deficit, and so it's going to take a lot of moisture to help kind of catch us back up. If you look at what the National Ag Statistics Service put out yesterday for the state of Kansas, we're way behind on topsoil moisture and on profile subsoil moisture, and so we're starting at a pretty good deficit for this year for sure.
Yeah, no question about it. That happens after a couple of years of drought. The condition ratings on the crop heavily favoring the poor and very poor. What was it, like 52% of the crop rated poor to very poor? It's really struggling this year, isn't it, Jeannie?
It really is, you know, and a lot of that is from a very dry fall when we were trying to get that crop established, and then just coming out of the winter and wheat greening up and not having a whole lot of help from Mother Nature as we moved throughout the winter. And so, yeah, everything, it's not surprising to see those types of numbers coming across for the whole state and specifically for the northwest corner of the state. Although if you look at the drought monitor, like 37% of the state, I think, is an exceptional drought or that D4 designation. And so that's a lot of western Kansas, although it stretches down into south central Kansas, which is a pretty heavy wheat producing area, too. So just really dry conditions across the state.
Yeah. Jeannie, what should that wheat crop be doing right now? Should it still be laying dormant or should it be starting to green up?
You know, we have a pretty good gradient across the state as we are bringing that wheat out of dormancy. It's not completely surprising that the northwest part of the state is just a little bit slower getting going. You know, we have snow on the ground right now, so that's okay. The southern, southeastern part of the state should be really greening up and kind of getting its feet under it and getting going, putting on spring tillers, which are really important, especially if you didn't have a chance to create many fall tillers. And so, you know, thinking about what that crop should be doing right now. It should be creating, it should be coming out of dormancy. It should be creating spring tillers. You know, we're moving to the point where we're looking for that growing point to be moving above the ground. And that's when we've really made that switch from vegetative state into reproductive mode. Mm-hmm. And so the wheat in Northwest Kansas should not be that far along, but the wheat in South Central Kansas should be taking some of those steps.
Okay. So what is it? You mentioned that you've traveled around the state a little bit here. How does it look down there?
In the northwest part of the state, we have pockets of wheat that looks really pretty decent, better than maybe what many folks think it should be, just based on the lack of moisture that we've had. But if you've been lucky enough to catch just a very timely shower or snow, then that has helped. If you move down into southwest Kansas, it gets really dry. I say relatively quickly, but as you're driving along, you're just seeing wheat that's just, you're not seeing much wheat in the fields, even though those fields have been drilled. And so in some cases, it's hard to row wheat. And I got out and looked at a field here about 2 weeks ago. And in some cases, you could see green wheat still coming, like it is germinated and it's under the soil surface and is slowly coming along. There's other places where you can see where there was wheat and it is dry and dead and not good shape. And so, and there's other wheat that hasn't emerged. I mean, we have some that's not emerged yet. And so we have a pretty good gradient of wheat conditions across the state. And then, you know, as you continue on around, I was kind of into central Kansas and some of that, you see a really nice field next to a field that's not in great shape. And some of that goes back to just production history. Is that double crop wheat? Was it worked a couple extra times? And so we're seeing some production things that are making a difference in our wheat stands.
Okay. All right. Jeannie, that wheat that may have been there last fall but didn't make it to the end of March, the wind that you guys dealt with this winter, that had to have an impact on some of that wheat that emerged, didn't it?
Yes, you know, as we're having those wind events and we have dust that's blowing, you know, we are doing damage to those leaves that are above ground. And so, you know, I kind of make the comment about wheat being sandblasted. In some cases, you know, it really does get to that state, you know, and some of those areas that had a lot of wind blowing, the crown was very protected on that wheat plant because it was below the soil surface. And so now we're just to the point where we're generating new leaves on some of that, and other parts of it, it just was too much. And you know, it's kind of an interesting discussion when we talk about wind damage, because wind doesn't happen just by itself. It's typically very dry conditions. We're not having a lot of cover, you know, and so there's many things that are adding together to get to that state where we have wind and soil blowing and dry conditions. It's just, it kind of feeds off of each other, it feels like.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, drought has been well documented. Concern has been well documented. What don't we know about that winter wheat crop out there? I mean, vulnerability to bugs, vulnerability to disease. What's got you concerned even beyond the drought?
You know, one of the things that always catches my attention when we have thinner than what we would like wheat stands is the concern of weed pressure coming into those fields. And because if we catch a timely rain, then we're going to have kochia plants, we're going to have Palmer amaranth, we're going to have some of those other weeds coming in. And so as we're thinking about managing some of those thinner than what we would like to see wheat stands, weed control is really important coming into that. And so important to make sure that we're putting down a herbicide that has good residual activity on it to kind of help hold those weeds back throughout the spring so that they can't get a jump on the wheat crop. And so that's when I think about pest management, that's the one that really jumps in my mind, thinking about how do we take care of the wheat that we have out there.
Yeah. Yeah, what I just heard you say, Jeannie, is if you fix one problem, you're going to have another one. it can be frustrating.
Yes, it can. Yeah. It can. And it's also frustrating for farmers because we're putting money into a not less than ideal wheat crop.
Yep. Yep. Okay. If you could write a prescription to get this crop back on its feet, what would it look like?
You know, in some cases, a prescription for getting it back on its feet is mostly going to be moisture.
Yeah.
And the other thing that would really help some of this thinner wheat is to have a cool, damp spring. And the reason I say that is because a lot of this wheat didn't have time or didn't have the moisture to create those fall tillers. Fall tillers are the most productive tillers that we can have on a wheat plant. But if we don't have two or three of those, spring tillers kind of help fill in. And we have to have cool, wet conditions to get those spring tillers formed and to give them a chance to really kind of kick into gear and to be productive tillers. And so a cool, wet spring would definitely be on my prescription for helping get those spring tillers formed, because they're going to be the ones that are forming heads that are going to add to yield. And so that's going to be one of the most important parts of that. The other thing is that we have to have the fertility in place, meaning that our nitrogen and phosphorus have to be out there in that root zone before we move to the jointing stage so we can impact our kernel number out there.
Exactly. Jeannie, great information. Wow. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Yes. Thanks for the invitation.
You bet. We'll talk again, I hope. Jeannie Falk-Jones, Kansas State Extension Agronomist.
To produce higher yields and greater value at harvest, timing is everything. Full Scale from Helena helps soybeans reach their full potential with breakthrough foliar nutrition and reproduction. Full Scale delivers beneficial plant extracts and micronutrients with the added efficiency of ENC formulation technology. It gives your soybeans every opportunity to grow strong returns this season. Contact your local ag retailer or Helena representative to learn more about Full Scale. Always read and follow label instructions and check registration status before use.
From powering irrigation engines to warming buildings, propane has always been a part of American farm life. Now, you can be a part of propane's future and save money at the same time. The Propane Farm Incentive Program is a research initiative that provides farmers up to $5,000 towards the purchase of new propane-powered equipment. In exchange, participants share performance data to make tomorrow's ag operations more cost-effective, more efficient, and more environmentally friendly with propane. Getting started is simple. Visit propane.com/farm incentive to see if you're eligible.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from ProFarmer.
ProFarmer editor Brian Grady joins us now. Beach, most of the grain markets are following through to yesterday's upside recovery. What do you see going on?
Yeah, starting the soy complex, soybeans and soy meal leading the way there, and pretty strong gain. So it looks like we posted V-bottom low on the soybean charts, and the market's starting to rebuild part of what we lost here recently. The wheat market, it's trading to the upside, being led by spring wheat futures amid the concerns about flooding in the Red River Valley and other areas of the Northern Plains as spring approaches. And then the HRW crop, which continues to struggle with the drought stress and those types of things. Corn market, not seeing a whole lot of buyer interest there. Actually, the old crop contracts are a little bit weaker despite another daily corn export sale to China. So the string, it just continues here, and now 3 million tons since March 14th have been sold to China, and two boatloads of that was to unknown destinations. Unknown.
Yeah, it is one of the more impressive strings of daily export sales announcements that I can recall, no question about it. Take us over to the livestock trade.
Well, we had explosive gains yesterday. Some of that's being taken back in the hog market, moderate to sharp losses here at mid-morning. So the cash index is down again today. That's six straight days, and so the market is pulling back on that. Live cattle futures, they're mixed with a slightly weaker tone in the front end of the market, waiting on cash cattle trade to develop, and in all likelihood, that won't be until later in the week.
All right, real good stuff. Thank you, Brian. That's ProFarmer editor Brian Grady. Brian will be with us this afternoon on AgriTalk.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors. When news breaks, the newsmakers talk about it on AgriTalk with Chip Flory.
Life is a gamble, a game we all play. How can you not like that right there? Huh?
You gotta love it. You gotta love it.
That just makes me feel good. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm Chip Flory. Davis, yesterday morning, final segment, we had Chad Ingles representing 68th District of Iowa in the Iowa House on to talk about House File 565. It has passed the House. It did not do so with Chad's vote because he didn't believe that the bill would provide the protections for landowners that that others believe.
Right.
So we're going to continue the conversation and going to take a big stride in that conversation right now. Elizabeth Burns Thompson is the VP of Government and Public Affairs at the Navigator CO2 Carbon Pipeline company, and she joins us again. Elizabeth, thank you so much for making time for us again.
Absolutely. Always good to be back with you, Chip.
All right. Glad that you're here. Before we get to some of the details of that House File 565, it has passed the House, but before we get to those details, what is the status of the Heartland Greenways efforts to work with landowners? How much of the ground that is needed for the project has voluntarily signed on?
Sure. So that is the million-dollar question I get each and every day. And if I gave you a status point right now, it would be outdated by the end of today and largely the end of this week. So we are continuing to make great strides. We are well into double digits in terms of progress points. There are some counties that, you know, we are almost nearly complete in. There are places where we have some work to do. I think that's reflective of necessarily the process being so relationship focused. You necessarily go out and develop those relationships like we've talked about before with landowners and farmers. They want to know who you are and what we're doing long before we can get into the dollars and cents or the language of an easement agreement. And frankly, that takes time. I think also to put it in perspective, I realize there's a lot of different projects that are being talked about across the state right now. We are at different stages of development. So we didn't come forward and begin negotiating with landowners until about October of last year. Unfortunately, that coincided with harvest and also going right into the holidays. So we've still got some places where we're working on getting in front of landowners and having those conversations, but we're continuing to make progress. I will give you a number because I know folks want some numbers, but to date on right away holistically, we have spent about $14 million or just over $14 million with about $10 million of that here in the state of Iowa.
Okay. All right. And I think you probably know the reason that I asked that question, because I think the House bill would require 90% voluntary participation before eminent domain could be used to complete the project. Do you think that 90% number is even possible?
I think it's a fair conversation to have. And it's a question that we get very early on. I regularly have folks ask, how much do you think that you're going to have to condemn? It would be very disingenuous of us or the company to even speculate in that before we've had the opportunity to actually go out and have holistic conversations with landowners to look at where there's flexibility in the route to determine what it is that they'd like to ask for in terms of be it routing flexibility, be it compensation flexibility, be it timing. You know, I think people look at negotiations specifically in dollars and cents, and it is far more broad than that. It's how we do the work, it's when we do the work, it's where we do the work. There's a lot that's on the table as part of those conversations, and necessarily so. I hope that kind of answers your question.
Yeah.
But
no,
yes,
it does, and again
each of the projects are at different stages, so
yes. Yeah, absolutely, Elizabeth. It definitely answers the question, because you're right. It's not just dollars and cents. It's the flexibility, as you mentioned, on the timing of when the project might be going through an area, and then the flexibility on the route. The flexibility on the route, Elizabeth, when I look at the different tiling patterns. I'm going to go straight to that. I look at the different tiling patterns across the state of Iowa. Some areas are heavily tiled. Some areas are not. One of the biggest concerns are the cut tile lines that might happen as a result of the pipeline going through. How do you address those concerns with landowners?
One, I think, is starting with an acknowledgement that we understand and respect that arguably one of the most expensive things outside of, you know, buying the land outright is the investments that these folks are making into drainage systems and tile. We have a pretty robust process of both temporary bridges that we put in place during that construction process, but then also flexibility in how that work is done from a permanent repair. And you and I both know that if you go back into the countryside, many of us have our tile guy, right? The guy that does all the tile, you know, in the area, and somebody that you know and trust. And that's important. So we've provided flexibility in our model for landowners to be able to either have us do that permanent repair if they so wish, or to be able to utilize a local contractor that again they know and trust. I think that also provides an opportunity for us to further, develop economic opportunity there locally by supporting local businesses and those local tile contractors as well. But again, it's back to that concept of is sometimes it's less about what's being done, but who they trust to do that work. And so we've been cognizant of that from step one.
Okay. Excellent. The other big issue that comes up, and we talked about this the last time that you were on, but let's just go over it again. The potential lost production on that pipeline scar. How is that concern being addressed?
Sure. And I'm glad you brought that up, Chip, because I realize that the slides that we've put out and some of the materials sometimes may look a little bit different than what is reality or kind of taken out of context. What we've laid out is a 5-year, compensation package, but we're paying that all up front. So what we're doing is we thought kind of a showing of good faith. Is 250% of anticipated crop loss paid before we break ground. So we know that crop loss is necessarily a result of pipeline construction. If we do our job right and the contractors do their job right and restoration does their job right, that ground should heal. Now, it won't heal immediately. It does take time, but that should heal and restore to its productivity potential that it is right now. However, I know that some folks see the 5-year calculation on those slides and think that it's somehow only limited to that. No, that is us providing that 250% upfront, again, as a showing of good faith. If, and this is another important caveat that I want to make sure that we highlight, but if a landowner experiences yield loss beyond that 250%, we are also responsible for that. That's a condition that is part of our operating permit. We are responsible for the impact of both the construction and operation of this pipeline on the landowners that we cross, be it, like I said, upfront during construction or throughout operations. So that's necessarily a condition that, you know, landowners will necessarily be made whole. And again, I highlight that also that, you know, down the road, we may need to come in and do work on a specific segment of the pipe. If that necessarily results in crop loss, you know, if we need to dig up a segment of the pipe or something along those lines to further evaluate, we necessarily then make you whole as it relates to compensation for further impacts down the road.
Okay. Okay. Interesting. Now, if House File 565, which is passed the House, if it passes the Iowa Senate, what do you think that means for these carbon capture utilization and storage projects?
You know, I'll answer that maybe a little bit differently in that I think what unfortunately the bill misses is the intent that the legislators were seeking, and the goal being protection of private property rights. Right. And where I think that we've missed the mark with this is right now, if you look at the state process and the state code, we have a process that ensures that every single landowner on that route has the same standard of review. They're looked at the same qualitative, right? The how, the where, the why, be it the very first landowner that signs an easement or number 89.9%. Or 90%, right? It's not just the first 90% that are given a certain level of review in comparison to the last 10%. we have a process that ensures that every landowner is protected, not just drawing an arbitrary line in the sand. So we think that the rules that exist right now ensure that private property protection. I think the other piece that really gives us pause is the fact that private property rights should exist similarly, regardless of what is running through that piece of infrastructure, be it a crude oil pipeline, be it a natural gas pipeline, or be it a CO2 pipeline, right? Your rights should exist much the same. And that's not the case, or was reflected in that particular piece of legislation.
Yeah, Monty Shaw at the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association made it very clear in his reaction that why should these rules apply only to the CO2 pipelines? Why don't they apply to the other pipelines that are carrying energy product across the state? And hey, that is hard to argue on it. Next steps here, Elizabeth. We've only got about 30 seconds left, but what's next for Navigator and the Heartland Greenway project?
Sure. We are focused entirely on doing outreach. So getting in front of landowners, getting in front of stakeholders. We've had a lot of robust outreach with county boards of supervisors and county governments. But we're actually just wrapping up another phase of outreach with our local EMS and first responders. So we did about 15 in-person meetings in January and February. We've done a couple of virtual meetings over the course of this week as well. So we're really ramping up outreach to get in front of folks.
Gotcha. Elizabeth, thank you so much. I appreciate your time very much.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Elizabeth Burns Thompson, VP of Government and Public Affairs at the Navigator CO2 Pipeline Project. A lot of work to be done yet on this, and some other efforts are underway as well that we're going to highlight in the future. Davis and I will be right back.
To produce higher yields and greater value at harvest, timing is everything. Full Scale from Helena helps soybeans reach their full potential with breakthrough foliar nutrition and reproduction. Full Scale delivers beneficial plant extracts and micronutrients with the added efficiency of ENC formulation technology. It gives your soybeans every opportunity to grow strong returns this season. Contact your local ag retailer or Helena representative to learn more about Full Scale. Always read and follow label instructions and check registration status before use.
From powering irrigation engines to warming buildings, propane has always been a part of American farm life. Now, you can be a part of propane's future and save money at the same time. The Propane Farm Incentive Program is a research initiative that provides farmers up to $5,000 towards the purchase of new propane-powered equipment. In exchange, participants share performance data to make tomorrow's ag operations more cost-effective, more efficient, and more environmentally friendly with propane. Getting started is simple. Visit propane.com/farm incentive to see if you're eligible.
The 2023 Bracket Busters Challenge presented by Case IH is underway. Who's still in the game? Find out. Head to agweb.com now through April 3rd to check the leaderboard. Welcome back to AgriTalk, everybody. Your pal Davis Michelson here with Chip Flory.
Yes.
So I was out yesterday. Just a programming note. On Tuesday of next week, a week from today, I'm going to be gone again for the afternoon show. Is it the afternoon show? I think the afternoon show. One of the shows.
Okay.
I'll be gone. I'm getting my teeth fixed.
Yeah.
Finally.
This has been going on a while, dude.
It's been going on a while. And still, okay. And listeners, if you've been listening for a few weeks now, you know, I mentioned it. There's still like a little space between the top of one of my front teeth and my gums. And every once in a while, it's like this sort of weird shot of air comes through there. It's very disconcerting. I'm learning to deal with it. I'm hoping that they can fix that, you know?
I would certainly hope so.
So we'll see. It's
okay.
It's kind of important to me. Anyway, just a little programming note.
We barely notice.
So you can say, well, I appreciate that. So you can, you know, you can set up your calendars for next week, everybody, to be just be aware. You know, I don't want anyone to be surprised.
Davis-less on Tuesday afternoon.
That's right. That's right. I'm sure it'll still be solid gold radio, though.
I'm sure. Yeah. Yeah. We'll try. Yeah. We'll do our best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chip, I bleed red, white, and blue.
Okay.
You know, God, guns, all that stuff. I'm in, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just do this. because I keep hearing about this carbon pipeline stuff, the whole plan with the carbon, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Pretend that I'm a greeny nut job hippie from wherever those people come from, okay?
Okay.
I'm in a complete climate panic. We're all going to die. The sky is falling. We're going to burn to death in like 2.5 years, okay? Imagine I'm that guy.
Yeah.
Those folks can be very vocal, okay? Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have the ear of the administration and of a lot of the general public.
Yeah.
What are those people saying about this concept? Because, indeed, to me, it does seem it's a little weird. You're taking carbon and capturing it from manufacturing processes or doing, you know, whatever to create mm-hmm. this. And then you're pumping it off site, and then you're going to drill it a mile down into the ground.
Well, it's going to go into the old fracking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. You have followed my train of thought here. Mm-hmm. To your knowledge, have we gotten any pushback on those lines? And do you reckon there's a plan in place to answer that?
Yeah, pushback on what lines?
Along the lines of the same folks who had a problem with fracking.
Okay.
Are they now going to show up and say, seriously, you're going to pump carbon into the earth now?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Well, take it out, put it back in.
Yeah.
I would venture a guess that the group that you are talking about would not be in favor of the pipeline. And you know what? I will admit, I don't believe I've received comments
mm-hmm.
or questions from someone fitting your description on this issue. But I would guess, and that's all this is,
okay.
is the person that you described would be against the project because they're against ethanol, because they're against liquid fuels, because mm-hmm. they want nothing but EVs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That would be the dots that I would connect on that one.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Couple of things, and the comments are coming in on this.
Good.
The difference on the pipelines, okay, because we made mention there at the end of the last segment that Monty Shaw, mm-hmm. the executive director at the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association, said, what's the difference between a natural gas pipeline, between a crude yeah. oil pipeline?
That's and a legit and a, question.
Yeah. Well, it is. It is. Got this question. There's a difference between an essential fuel or natural gas pipeline versus a carbon pipeline. The fuel is needed by everyone. Carbon capture obviously isn't.
Well, that's interesting.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, some would argue that the carbon capture is needed so that we can have a biofuel that is net zero carbon or even negative carbon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. boy, there's a lot of different roads that we can go down. And of course, there are other alternatives out there, and I'm looking in. I hear you, Jeff. There are some other issues that I am that are possibilities that I'm looking into, trying to judge some legitimacy, trying to judge the
yeah.
scope of a project, because these are really important questions.
Mm-hmm.
The answers are more important than the questions. Okay?
Yes.
Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Yep. And the reason that I say that is because if there is a legitimate alternative that provides the same kind of benefits to the ethanol industry, to the farmers that have invested in the ethanol industry, to corn producers in general, from the biofuels, then they absolutely must be considered. I don't know where this is going to end up, to be honest with you. I have got friends and people that I rely on to tell me the truth of what they are thinking on issues. Dude, I'm telling you, I don't think I've dealt with an issue, and this includes the cattle markets. I've dealt with an issue where the opinions are coming at me from such diverging points of view. Yeah. It's incredible.
Well, let's keep our finger on the pulse of this one.
We're definitely going to have to keep doing that. Hey, thanks for listening this morning. Appreciate it very much. Come back this afternoon. We've got Brian Grady, editor of Pro Farmer, here on AgriTalk.